3.
Take me to my house, she said to Bobby Tremaine. Quick, I know what to do.
You're there.
He took her arm and began pulling her toward the door. Hold it, she said.
Huh?
Don't you think I better...
Bring the photograph,
she finished.
Oh, shit,
Bobby said and slapped his forehead. 4. Dick Allison, meanwhile, who was chief of Haven's volunteer fire department, was sitting in his office sweating bullets in spite of the air conditioning, fielding telephone calls. The first was from the Troy constable, the second from the Unity chief of police, the third from the state police, the fourth from AP. He probably would have been sweating anyway, but one of the reasons the air conditioning wasn't doing him any good was his door had been blown off its hinges by the force of the blast. Most of the plaster had fallen off the walls, revealing lathing like decayed ribs. He sat in the middle of the wreckage and told his callers that it sure had been a hell of a bang, and it looked as if they probably had had one fatality, but it was nowhere near as bad as it had probably sounded. While he was rolling out this bullshit for the guy from the Bangor Daily News named John Leandro, a cork ceiling panel fell on his head. Dick slashed it aside with a wolfish snarl, listened, laughed, and said it was just the bulletin board. Goddamn thing had fallen over again. It just had those sucker things on the back, you know. Well, if you bought cheap, you got cheap, his mother had always told him, and... It took another 5 minutes, but he finally bored Leandro off the phone. As he put his own telephone back in the cradle, most of the hallway ceiling outside his door fell with a powdery crump. Motherfucking cock-sucking son of a fucking bitch! Dick Allison screamed, and brought his left fist down on his desk as hard as he could. Although he broke all 4 fingers, he didn't even notice in his raving fury. If, at that moment, anyone had come into his office, Allison would have ripped that person's throat open, filled his mouth with hot blood, and then sprayed it back into the dying person's face. He screamed and swore and even drummed his feet up and down on the floor like a child doing a tantrum because he has been denied an outing. He looked childish. He also looked extremely dangerous. Tommyknockers, knocking at the door. 5. In between phone calls, Dick went into Hazel's office, found the My Doll in her drawer, and took 6. Then he wrapped his throbbing, swelling hand tightly and forgot it. If he had still been human, this would have been impossible. One does not simply forget 4 broken fingers. But since then he had become... One of the things that included was becoming able to exercise conscious will over pain. It came in handy. In between his conversations with the outside, and sometimes during them, Dick spoke to the men and women working furiously at Henry Applegate's. He told them he expected a couple of state cops by 4:30, 5 o'clock at the latest. Could they have the slide projector ready by then? When Hazel explained the problem, Dick began to rave again, this time with fear as well as anger. When Hazel explained what Christina Lindley was up to, he calmed. A little. She had a home darkroom. There she would carefully make a negative of the Yankee picture and enlarge it slightly, not because it needed to be bigger for the slide projector device to work, and too much enlarging would give their clock tower illusion an odd, grainy look, but because she needed a slightly bigger image to work with.
She's going to turn a negative, Hazel said in his mind. Then airbrush out the hands on the clock face. Bobby Tremaine is going to put them back in with an X-Acto knife, so they say 305. He's got a steady hand and a little talent. Right now, a steady hand seems more important.
I thought if you made a negative from a positive, it came out blurry,
Dick Allison said.
Especially if the positive's color.
She's improved her developing equipment, Hazel said.
She didn't need to add that 17-year-old Christina Lindley now had what was probably the most advanced darkroom on Earth.
So how long?
Midnight, she thinks,
Hazel said.
Christ on a pony,
Dick shouted, loud enough to make the people in Henry's field wince.
We'll need about 30 D-cells.
Bobby Anderson's voice cut in calmly.
Be a love and see to that, Dick. And we understand about the police. Play hee-haw for them, you understand?
He paused.
Yes,
he said.
Buck and Roy, junior samples. Exactly. And hold them. It's their radio I'm really worried about, not them. They'll only send one unit, two at most to start with, but if they see, if they radio it in...
There was a murmur of assent, like the sound of the ocean in a conch shell.
Is there a way you can damp out their transmissions from town?
Bobby asked.
Aye.
Andy Baker suddenly cut in. Gleeful.
I got a better idea. Get Buck Peters to shuck his fat ass over to the gas station right now.
Yes.
Bobby overrode him, her thoughts shrill with excitement.
Good. Great. And when they leave town, someone... Beach, I think.
Beach was honored to be chosen. 6. Bent Rhodes and Jingles Gabbins of the Maine State Police arrived in Haven at 5:15. They came expecting to find the smoky, uninteresting aftermath of a furnace explosion, one old pumper truck idling at the curb, 20 or 30 onlookers idling on the sidewalk. Instead, they found the entire Haven Town Hall clock tower blown off like a Roman candle. Bricks littered the street, windows were blown out, there were dismembered dolls everywhere, and too damned many people going about their business. Dick Ellison greeted them with weird cordiality, as if this was a Republican bean supper instead of what now looked like a disaster of real magnitude.
"Christ almighty, man, what happened here?"
Bent asked him.
"Well, I guess maybe it was a little worse than I made out over the phone,"
Dick said, surveying the brick-littered street, and then giving the two troopers an incongruous, "Ain't I a bad boy?" smile.
"Guess I didn't think anyone would believe it unless they saw it."
Jingles muttered,
"I'm seeing it, and I don't believe it."
They had both dismissed Dick Ellison as a small-town bumbler, probably crazy in the bargain. That was all right. He stood behind them, watching them stare at the wreckage. The smile faded gradually from his face, and his expression became cold. Rhodes spotted the human arm amid all the tiny make-believe limbs when he turned back to Dick. His face was whiter than it had been, and he looked considerably younger.
"Where's Mrs. McCausland?"
he said. His voice rose uncontrollably and broke on the last syllable.
"Well, you know, I think that might be part of our problem,"
Dick began.
"You see..."
7. Dick did hold them in town as long as he could without being conspicuous about it. It was 7:45 before they left, and by then twilight was drawing down. Also, Dick knew, if they didn't leave soon, they would start wondering how come none of the backup units they had requested were arriving. They had both talked on their cruiser's radio to Derry Base, and both hung the mic up again looking puzzled and distracted. The responses they were getting from the other end were right. It was the voice that seemed a little off. But neither of them could be bothered with such a minor matter, at least not for the time being. There were too many other things to cope with. The magnitude of the accident, for one thing, the fact that they had known the victim, for another. Trying to lay the groundwork of a potentially big case without committing any of the procedural fuck-ups that would muddy the waters later on, for a third. Also, they were beginning to feel the effects of being in Haven. They were like men applying vinyl seal to a big wooden floor in a room with no ventilation, getting stoned without even knowing it. They weren't healing thoughts. It was too early for that, and they would be gone before it could happen, but they were feeling very strange. It was slowing them down, making ordinary routine something they had to fight their way through. Dick Ellison got all this from their minds as he sat across the street drinking a cup of coffee in the Haven lunch.
"Ah, yeah."
They were too busy and too screwed up to think about the fact that...
Tug Ellender.
Their dispatcher didn't exactly sound like himself tonight. The reason why was very simple. They weren't talking to Tug Ellender. They were talking to Buck Peters. Their radio transmissions were not going to and coming from Derry, but to and from the garage of Elt Barker's shell, where Buck Peters was hunched, sweating, over a microphone, with Andy Baker beside him. Buck sent out fresh instructions and information on Andy's radio, a little something he had scrambled together in his spare time, a little something that could have contacted life on Uranus, had there been any good buddies up there to send back a big 10-4. Several townspeople were concentrating hard on the mines of Bent Rhodes and Jingles Gavins. They relayed to Buck everything they were able to pick up about Ellender, from whom the cops just naturally expected to hear. Buck Peters had some natural mimicry. He was a great hit doing whoever happened to be president that year, plus such favorites as Jimmy Cagney and John Wayne at each year's Grange Stage Spectacular. He was not Rich Little, never would be, but when he did somebody, you knew who it was, usually. More important, the listeners were able to relay to Buck how he should respond to each transmission, since almost every speaker knows in his own mind what response he expects to get from his questions or statements. If Bent and Jingles bought the impersonation, and to a large extent they really did, it wasn't so much due to Buck's talents as to their own fulfilled expectations in Tug's replies. Andy had further been able to blur Buck's voice by overlaying some static, not as much as they would hear on their way back to Derry, but enough so that Tug's voice grew a little blurred whenever that oddness,
"Jesus, that doesn't sound like Tug much at all. I wonder, does he have a cold?"
surfaced in one of their minds. At 7:15, when Beach brought him a fresh cup of coffee, Dick asked, "You all set?"
"Sure am."
"And you're sure that gadget will work?" "It works fine. Want to see it?" Beach was almost fawning.
"No, there isn't time. What about the deer? You got that?"
"Aye, yeah. Bill Elderly killed it, and Dave Rutledge dressed it out."
"That's good. Get going."
"Okay, Dick." Beach took off his apron and hung it on a nail behind the counter. He turned over the sign which hung above the door, from open to closed. Ordinarily, it would just have hung there, but tonight, because the glass was broken, it stirred and twisted in the mild breeze. Beach paused and looked back at Dick with narrow, sunken anger.
"She wasn't supposed to do nothing like that," he said.
Dick shrugged. It didn't matter. It was done.
"She's gone. That's the important thing. The kids are doing fine with that picture. As for Ruth, there's no one else like her in town. There's that fellow out at the old Garrick place. He's drunk all the time, and he wants to dig it up. Go on, Beach. They'll be leaving soon, and we want it to happen as far out of the village as you can make it happen."
"Okay, Dick. Be careful." Dick smiled.
"We all got to be careful now. This is touchy."
He watched Beach get into his truck and back out of the space in front of the Haven Lunch that had been that old Chevy's home for the last 12 years. As the truck started up the street, Beach driving slowly and weaving to avoid the litters of broken glass, Dick could see the shape under the tarp in the truck's bed, and near the back something else, wrapped in a sheet of heavy plastic. The biggest deer Bill Elderly had been able to find on such short notice. Deer hunting was most definitely against the law during July in the state of Maine. When Beach's pickup was out of sight, "Make love, not war, be ready for both, NRA," the bumper sticker on the tailgate read, Dick turned back to the counter and picked up his coffee cup. As always, Beach's coffee was strong and good. He needed that. Dick was more than tired. He was worn out. Although there was still good light left in the sky, and although he had always been the sort of person who found it impossible to go to sleep until the national anthem had played on the last available TV channel, all he wanted now was his own bed. This had been a tense, frightening day, and it wouldn't be over until Beach reported in. Nor would the mess Ruth McCausland had succeeded in making be cleaned up when the two cops were erased. They could hide a lot of things, but not the simple fact that those cops had been on their way back from Haven, where another cop, just a town constable, true, but a cop was a cop, and this one had once been married to a state bear, just to add to the fun, had been erased from the equation. All of which meant that the fun was just beginning.
"If you call it fun,"
Dick said sourly to no one in particular.
"Be dog-fucked if I do."
The coffee began to burn with acid indigestion in Dick's stomach. He went on drinking it anyway. Outside, a powerful motor roared. Dick swiveled around on his stool and watched the cops drive out of town, the flashers on top of their cruiser swinging blue light and black shadow on the wreckage. 8. Christina Lindley and Bobby Tremaine stood side by side, watching the blank sheet in the developing bath, neither of them breathing as they waited for the image to come or not come. Little by little, it did. There was the Haven Town Hall clock tower, in living, true color, and the hands of the clock stood at 3:05.
Bobby let out his breath in a low, slow exhalation.
Perfect,
he said.
Not quite,
Christina said.
There's one more thing.
He turned to her, apprehensive.
What? What's wrong? Nothing. Everything's right. It's just that there's one more thing we have to do.
She was not ugly, but because she wore glasses and her hair was mouse brown, she had always considered herself ugly. She was 17 and had never been on a date. Now none of that seemed to matter. She unzipped her skirt and pushed it, her rayon half-slip, and her cotton panties, both bought at the discount store in Derry, down. She stepped out of them and carefully took the wet photograph from the developing bath. She stood on tiptoe to hang it up, smooth buttocks flexing. Then she turned to him, legs spread.
I need doing.
He took her standing up against the wall. When her hymen burst, she bit his shoulder hard enough to bring blood from him as well, and when they came together, they did it snarling and clawing, and it was very, very good.
Just like old times,
Bobby thought, as he drove them out to the Applegate place, and wondered exactly what he meant by that. Then he decided it really didn't matter anyway. 9. Beach got his Chevy pickup to a creaky 65 as fast as it would go. One of the few things he hadn't gotten around to overhauling with his fantastic new knowledge was the old bomber. But he hoped it would get him as far as he needed to go tonight, and old Betsy came through for him again. When he had gotten over the Troy Town line without hearing them or seeing any sign of their flashers behind him, he eased the truck back to 55, with some relief it had been on the edge of overheating, and when he got into Newport, he dropped back to 45. Dark was coming on hard by then. He was over the Derrytown line and just starting to worry that the frigging cops had gone back some other way. It seemed unlikely, since this was the quickest way, but Jesus, where were they? When he heard the low mutter of their thoughts. He pulled over and sat quietly for a moment, head cocked, eyes half closed, listening, making sure. His mouth, oddly infirm and puckered, with most of the teeth gone, was the mouth of a much older man. It was something about
Freckle.
Ruth. It was them, all right. The thought came clearer.
You could see the freckles right through the blood.
And Beach nodded. It was them, all right. They were coming along fast. He'd have time, but only if he hustled. Beach drove another quarter of a mile up the road, rounded a curve, and saw the last long stretch of Route 3 between here and Derry. He turned his pickup sideways, blocking the road. Then he removed the tarp from the rifle thing and back, fingers plucking nervously at hay rope knots as their voices grew stronger, stronger, stronger in his head. When their lights splashed the trees on this side of the curve, Beach got his head down. He reached for the train transformers, six of them, that had been nailed to a board, and the board had been bolted to the truck bed so it wouldn't slide around, and turned them on one after another. He heard the hum as they powered up. Then that sound, every sound, was lost in a shriek of brakes and tires. Now light that was flashbulb white and shot through with strobing blue flashes filled the bed of the pickup truck, and Beach pressed himself against the bottom, hands laced over his head, thinking he had blown it. Parked too close to a blind turn, and they were going to crash into his truck, and they might only be injured, but he would be killed, and they would find the ruins of his rifle and say,
well now, what's this?
And...
You fucked up, Beach. They saved your life, and you fucked up. Oh, damn you, damn you, damn you.
Then the shrieking tires stopped. The smell of cooked rubber was strong and sickening, but the crash for which he had been braced hadn't come. Blue lights strobed. A microphone crackled static. Dimly, he heard the hoarse-voiced cop say, what's this shit? Shakily, Beach did a girly push-up and peered over the edge of the truck bed with just his eyes. He saw their cruiser halted at the end of a long pair of black skid marks. Even by starlight, those marks were clearly visible. The cruiser was sitting at a cockeyed angle not 9 feet away.
If they had been going just 5 miles an hour faster. Yeah, but they weren't.
Sounds. The double clunk of their doors closing as they got out of their car. The faint dull hum of the transformers which powered his gadget. A gadget that was not all that different from the ones Ruth had planted in the bellies of her dolls. And a low buzzing sound. Flies. They smelled the blood under the plastic sheet but couldn't get at the deer's carcass.
You'll get your chance soon enough.
Beach thought. And grinned.
Too bad you won't get a taste of those old boys out there.
I saw that truck back in Haven, Bent, the hoarse-voiced one said, parked in front of the restaurant.
Beach swiveled the culvert pipe slightly in its cradle. Looking through it, he could see them both, and if one of them moved out of the actual power axis of the gadget, that was okay. There was a slight flare effect.
Get away from the car, boys.
Beach thought, picking up the doorbell from Western Auto and settling a thumb on it. His grin showed pink gums.
Don't want to get out of the car. Move away, all right?
Who's there?
The other cop shouted.
Tommy Knocker's here, knocking at your door, you meddling shithead.
He thought, and began to giggle. He couldn't help it. He tried to stifle it as best he could.
If someone's in that truck, you better speak up.
He began to giggle louder, just couldn't help it. And maybe that was just as well, because they took a look at each other, and then began to move toward the truck, unholstering their guns. Toward the truck and away from their cruiser. Beach waited until he was sure the cruiser wouldn't be touched by the flare. They had told him not to harm the police car, and he intended not to take so much as a layer of chrome off the bumper. When the cops were clear, Beach pushed the doorbell.
Avon calling, shitheads,
he thought. And this time he didn't just giggle, he whooped. A thick branch of green fire shot out in the dark, catching both of the policemen and enveloping them. Beach saw several bright yellow sparks inside that green glare and understood that one of the cops was triggering his pistol off again and again. Beach could smell the thick aroma of cooking train transformers. There was a sudden pop and a twisting skyrocket of sparks from one of them. Some of the sparks landed on his arm, stinging, and he brushed them off. The green fire, coming from the end of the culvert, winked out. The policemen were gone. Well, almost gone. Beach jumped over the tailgate of the truck, moving just as fast as he could. This wasn't the turnpike, God knew, and no one from the country headed into Derry to go shopping this late. But someone would be along sooner or later. He should... Sitting on the pavement was a single smoking shoe. He picked it up, almost dropped it. He hadn't expected it to be so heavy. Looking inside, he saw why. A sock-encased foot was still inside it. Beach carried it back to his truck and tossed it into the cab. When he got back to town, he would get rid of it. No need to bury it. There were more efficient ways of getting rid of things in Haven.
If the Mafia knew what us Yankee hicks got up here, I guess they'd want to buy them the franchise.
Beach thought, and tittered again. He pulled the pins on the tailgate. It fell flat open with a rusty crash. He grabbed the plastic-wrapped carcass of the deer. Whose idea had this been, he wondered, old Dave's? Didn't really matter. In Haven, all ideas were now becoming one. The plastic-wrapped bundle was heavy and awkward. Beach got his arms around the buck's rear legs and pulled. It came out of the truck, its head thudding onto the tarvey. Beach looked around again for brightening headlights on either horizon, saw none, and dragged the deer across the road as fast as he could. He put it down with a grunt and flipped the carcass over so he could free the plastic. Now he got the deer, which had been neatly gutted and cleaned, in both arms and picked it up. Cords stood out in his neck like cables. His skin-back lips would have shown his teeth, had any been left in his gums. The deer's head with its half-grown antlers hung down below his right forearm. Its dusty eyes stared off into the night. Beach staggered 3 steps down the sloping soft shoulder and threw the deer's body into the ditch, where it landed with a thud. He stepped away and picked up the plastic. He carried it back to the truck and bundled it into the passenger side of the cab. He would have liked it better in back. It stank. But there was always a chance it would blow out and be found. He hurried around to the driver's side of the truck, plucking his blood-dampened shirt away from his chest with a little grimace as he did.
He'd change as soon as he got home. He got in and started Betsy's motor. He backed and filled until he was pointed back toward Haven, and then paused for just a moment, surveying the scene, trying to see if the story it told was the one it was supposed to tell. He thought it did. Here was a Bearmobile, sitting dead empty in the middle of the road at the end of a long skid, engine off, lashers going. There was the gutted carcass of a good-sized buck in the ditch. That wouldn't go unnoticed long, not in July. Was there anything in this story that whispered Haven? Beach didn't think so. This story was about two cops returning to barracks after investigating a single fatality accident. They just happened to run on a gang of men jacklighting deer. What happened to the cops? Ah, that was the question, wasn't it? And the possible answers would look more and more ominous as the days passed. There were jackliters in the story. Jackliters who'd perhaps panicked, shot a couple of cops, and then buried them in the woods. But Haven? Beach really believed they would think that was a completely different story, one nowhere near as interesting. Now, in his rearview mirror, he could see approaching headlights. He put his truck in low and skirted the police cruiser. Its flashers bathed him in half a dozen blue pulse beats, and then it was behind him. Beach glanced to his right, saw the regulation-issue black shoe with its runner of regulation blue sock poking out like the tail of a kite, and cackled.
Bet when you put that shoe on this morning, Mr. Smartass State Bear, you didn't have no idea where it would finish up tonight.
Beach Jernigan cackled again and fetched second gear with a ram and a jerk. He was headed home, and he had never felt doodly damn better in his whole life. Chapter 8. Ev Hillman. 1. Lead story, Bangor Daily News, July 25, 1988. Two state police disappear in Derry. Area-wide manhunt begins. By David Bright. The discovery of an abandoned state police cruiser in Derry last night, shortly after 9:30, has touched off the second major search of the summer in eastern and central Maine. The first was for 4-year-old David Brown of Haven, who is still missing. Ironically, the officers, Benton Rhodes and Peter Gabbins, were returning from that same town at the time of their disappearance, having just completed their preliminary investigation of a furnace fire which took one life. See related story this page. In a late development, which one police insider described as the worst possible news we could have at this time, the body of a deer which had been shot, gutted, and cleaned was found near the cruiser, leading to speculations that... 2. There. Look at that. Beach said to Dick Allison and Newt Beringer over coffee the next morning. End of side 9. To continue, turn the cassette over.